this is my last broadcast as the anchorman of the CBS Evening News. For me, it's a moment for which I long have planned, but which nevertheless comes with some sadness. For almost two decades, after all, we've been meeting like this in the evenings, and I'll miss that. But those who have made anything of this departure, I'm afraid, have made too much. This is but a transition, a passing of the baton. And that's the way it is. Friday, March 6th, 1981. Good night.
Walter Cronkite signing off. A generation later, the news industry has been transformed into something he might not recognize. Well, today, the annual Pew Research Center's report on the state of the media is out. As expected, there's a big increase in digital news. 30% of Americans get their news now from Facebook. But, and this might reassure Cronkite, most Americans still get their news from TV. Amy Mitchell's here now. She's lead author of the Pew Report. Welcome.
Nice to join you.
Well, the storyline for the past few years has been that digital news outlets have been on the rise as newspapers continue to shrink, both in terms of jobs and revenue. And is that still the case?
Well, it's actually a pretty new development this year around the buildup of digital native sites, both large national sites like BuzzFeed and Mashable, as well as some of the smaller, more locally focused sites. Really digging into original kind of original news reporting in new ways and also bringing in new kinds of revenue streams.
And they're really expanding in global markets, you report, and opening bureaus overseas as newspapers close their bureaus.
One of the things that we did notice is that one of the editorial focuses has been on developing international reporting power. The Huffington Post wants to grow to being present in 15 countries, up from 11 where they currently are. Vice has 35 overseas bureaus. BuzzFeed is moving into Mumbai and Berlin. Quartz, which is a digital division of The Atlantic magazine, which has been around for a long time, but Quartz is new, and their staff speaks 19 different languages, they say. So this is an area of coverage, an area of focus that has not seen much development in the U.S., and if anything, has seen a pullback in the U.S. Over the last many, many years. So it will be interesting to watch and see what kind of new information is being provided.
Right. And how do they afford that? Because traditional news outlets have closed foreign bureaus primarily because they're really expensive.
Well, they're bringing in new kinds of revenue. And some of this is coming from people with deep pockets, wealthy individuals like Jeff Bezos, like Omidyar, who started eBay. Some of this is venture capital money. A lot of the development around these digital sites is a combination of people from the tech industry who understand technology and how to develop content and tell stories in the digital space, joined with well-known journalists who have been doing reporting and know how to tell stories and that gather data and get information out to people. So that new kind of technological understanding is something that certain individuals are willing to invest in.
So these organizations have to rely on the money from these really rich people, not necessarily from digital subscriptions or from online advertising.
Well, and that's a really important point, that none of these have really suggested a new revenue model.
Now, what is this trend in native advertising that is in your report? It seems to be growing. First, tell us what it is and why it's migrating to traditional news outlets.
Yeah, it's a difficult concept to explain to people, but if you think back in the magazine, print magazine era, where sometimes you'd come across a page in the magazine where there was a border with a little different color and then some content that sort of looked like the magazine content and sort of looked like an advertisement, it's that kind of content which is paid for by advertisers and lives on sort of within the published news content of different news sites. Mashable, the New York Times is now doing this, the Washington Post is now doing this, the Atlantic is now doing this. What's different in many cases is that it can, A, be harder to tell the difference between that advertisement and a news story. They're structured to look like a news story. They often have a byline from a journalist, often somebody who's on staff. And there are times when many of these organizations have actually created parts of spin-off from their newsroom using some of their same newsroom staff to write the content that's in these advertised pieces. So it can be very hard for the consumer to distinguish between the two. And the point of question is, what sort of relationship are you creating there, and what kind of loyalty are you potentially putting at risk when it comes to your relationship with your audience?
Okay, let's move on to broadcast and to TV, local TV, and most Americans, that's where they get their news, and maybe they hear something like this.
It's a 6 News investigation.
Tonight at 11 on Channel 3 News. Sex behind bars.
Tonight, parents think about this. Booze-soaked tampons to catch a buzz.
Live to be 100 all day Monday in every newscast on KPSP Local 2 News.
All right. You write that, and this is just really is an amazing statistic, a quarter of local television stations don't produce their own news.
That's exactly right. And one of the big trends of the last year has been a massive increase in local television acquisitions, or local television sales, if you will. The number of sales, the number of stations that changed hands in 2013 was up 205% over 2012. And the total dollar value amounted to $8 billion. What's driving these sales is, again, revenue-based. So it has to do with increased retransmission fees that these stations can charge when a local cable channel wants to re-air some of the content from your network. The more stations you amass, the more leverage you have at the negotiating table to demand a higher fee. Along with that consolidation under big owners has come a sharing of newscasts, a sharing of programming, where in some cases you have the exact same news program airing on Channel 2 and airing on Channel 4. Or you might have the anchor team is different, but half of the stories are the same. Or they share actually newsroom space. The impact on the consumer here seems to vary market to market. There are some cases where maybe Channel 2 never had any news before. In other cases, when two newsrooms consolidate, the reporting staff shrinks, and you've actually got, you know, fewer boots on the ground to go out and do deep stories.
Okay, another area that got a lot of attention was the Hispanic market, a fast-growing Latino market, and a lot of news organizations creating special channels or programming for that market. How did that go?
So one of the big things that is happening demographically in our country is a lot of demographic shifts, where we're starting to see very significant population changes. If we look at the Hispanic population alone, which is the largest ethnic group here in our country, they have that part of our population has grown 50% from 2000 to 2012 and now accounts for 53 million people as of 2012. Part of what that's impacting is news in our country. And what we've seen is more U.S. news companies like ABC and NBC get into the Hispanic market. Since 2010, 6 national Hispanic outlets have launched, and all are either owned in full or in partnership by one of these general market media companies. So Huffington Post Latino Voices, NBC Latino, Fusion, which is a partnership. A couple of them have failed. NBC Latino actually closed earlier this year, as did CNN Latino. And so there's a question of, you know, to what degree are U.S. media companies and U.S. news organizations going to be either creating specialized content for Hispanic audiences, or starting to bring a Hispanic orientation and certain amount of coverage that speaks to the Latino population into their general news products.
Amy Mitchell, Director of Journalism Research at the Pew Research Center, whose report on the state of the news media is out today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Speaking of the news industry, one of its most powerful players announced some changes today. In a surprise move, 83-year-old Rupert Murdoch is giving his two sons new positions in his companies, apparently setting them up to succeed him. His oldest son, Lachlan Murdoch, was named non-executive co-chair of 21st Century Fox and News Corp today, and his brother James has been promoted to co-chief operating officer at 21st Century Fox. Rupert Murdoch will remain in charge for now, but the new appointments have big implications for the future of the Murdoch media empire. And to sort all that out, we're joined by Ken Auletta. He writes the Annals of Communications column for The New Yorker. He's also the author of many books, including Three Blind Mice, How the TV Networks Lost Their Way. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
Well, let's begin with the older son, Lachlan. He left News Corp a while ago in 2005, and he hasn't been with the company since. So what drew him back?
His father. Essentially, he was angry. He felt like his father was micromanaging him when he was at News Corp through 2005, as you said. And he was having disputes with some of the executives under Mr. Murdoch's care. So he said, I'm going home. I'm going back to Australia with my family. I'll become an investor. And his father was very distraught about this. And family is central to him in his life in most respects. And we'll get to what respect where it's not central. But then what happened is that he has courted, romanced his son to bring him back. He brought him back a couple of years ago to join the board of News Corp, where he's been serving. And now today he announces that Lachlan, in fact, will part-time, not full-time, be the executive chairman.
And James, the other brother, he was tainted by the phone hacking scandal in Britain. So is that all behind him?
Well, you know, they're acting as if it is. I mean, clearly he has a lot to answer for. I'm not saying legally, but certainly ethically. I mean, it was on his watch that scandal took place, and he and other executives didn't do their due diligence. But the father, he's a very able man. He's done had spectacular success at Sky TV in Europe, and before that he had run the Asian operations for his dad. And so his father, to draw him away from the controversy, brought him to America and gave him a major position. He's a very able young man. He's about 38 now. And now he's got a promotion as co-chief operating officer. So in his father's eyes, and certainly he is free of taint and is positioned, as is his brother, to succeed the old man.
Now, there is another sibling, Elizabeth, and you wrote a blog post today at The New Yorker, and you wrote about her, and you said, if this story were covered in a Murdoch tabloid, the headline would be The Jilted Daughter.
Absolutely. She is the eldest of the three daughters from Murdoch's second wife, and many people feel the most able of the children. And she had great success. She had worked for the father, for the News Corp, for a number of years, went off on her own, and built a very successful television production company in England called Shine. And then the father, eager to bring her back into the fold, I mean, again, family is very important, buys her company, Shine, for over $600 million. And she is chairman, but she's not an employee working there full-time. I mean, she does her other things. But what she alienated her brother, James, by basically telling her father during the hacking scandal in Great Britain that he should remove James, that James was responsible, and that her father should pay more attention to the scandal, which is really going to wreak havoc on News Corp's reputation. And the father didn't listen to her. James was offended, the brother was offended by this, and stopped speaking to his sister. Lachlan, kind of in the middle, had a good relationship with his sister Elizabeth, but basically was in Australia and not engaged. The father, Rupert Murdoch, then becomes very irate at Elizabeth's husband, Matthew Freud, who's a very prominent publicist in Great Britain, feeling that he was undermining News Corp, putting up stories that were undermining and sabotaging the reputation of News Corp, and was influencing his wife, poisoning her against the family.
Wow.
And so what's happened is that Rupert Murdoch doesn't speak to his son-in-law, and for a and has an estranged relationship from his daughter Elizabeth, and has and her brother James has an estranged relationship from Elizabeth. So the person who was missing from the announcement, as I said today, was Elizabeth.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, it almost sounds like something. It's like King Lear. She's Cordelia, and he's anyway. It's this.
You betcha.
The parallels are.
It's a great analogy.
Are striking. And meanwhile, just to add into this whole soap opera, a Shakespearean level, there is the ex-wife Wendy Deng, who also has two. They have two daughters together, two small daughters, and she wants them to have a role when they become of age.
Well, she wants them to have a role. They will not have an equal role to James, Elizabeth, the elder daughter, Priscilla, from the first marriage, and Lachlan. Those four children have more voting rights and more equity in the company than the two younger daughters, who are not even teenagers yet. So Wendy lost that battle, but she did win a partial victory in that the daughters will have a say, and obviously the father wants that to be the case. He's not fighting that, but it gets into a whole other drama between the second wife and the third wife. But in any case, the two younger daughters will not have the same say as the four older children.
Okay, and so we have just a little bit less than a minute left, and I'm just wondering what this all means for us, the consumers of all this media that they produce.
Well, clearly what you're going to have, what it signals is that the succession plan, Mr. Murdoch is 83 years old, will at some point no longer be in charge, and he's saying that his two children certainly will be, his two sons will be in charge in some way. But there are two companies now. News Corp is split into two. So you can imagine Lachlan, who cares more about newspapers, running the newspaper print side, the publishing side, and James, who's much more interested in television, running the television side.
All right. Ken Auletta writes the Annals of Communications column for The New Yorker. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And coming up on the program, the hidden delights of broccoli, the much maligned vegetable slowly entering the foodie spotlight. That's coming up next on Press Play.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand, and here's a little public radio inside lingo for you. You know, sometimes during our editorial meetings, we bat around a bunch of ideas, and then one will come up and we'll call it broccoli. And that means a story that's really important that we should know and we should cover, but it's a little boring. So we call it broccoli. You have to eat it because it's good for you. Well, okay, right now we're not going to do that kind of segment, but we will be doing a segment on broccoli itself. And, well, I hope it's not boring. And the odds are it won't be because Dan Pashman is here. Dan is host of The Sporkful, it's a podcast, and the Cooking Channel web series, You're Eating It Wrong, and he has delved into all the fascinating insider tidbits about broccoli. Hi.
Hey, Madeline.
Okay, you say it's not boring, so prove us wrong.
That's right, it's not boring. I think it's very exciting, and not just for twee vegetable lover types, for all of us. I mean, there's a couple of things I think broccoli really has going for it. The first thing is textural contrast. It has these two different parts. It has the stems and it has the florets. And they cook at different rates and they end up in different textures. Most vegetables, if you cook a carrot or a string bean, it's going to be whatever level of crispiness or softness you cook it at. Broccoli can have two different textures at once. You can have crunch and softness. And then the other thing is that the florets are absorbent. Most vegetables don't absorb things in the way that those florets do, the way they mop up sauces. Everything from your classic Chinese takeout brown sauce, that's why the broccoli is so good in that sauce,
yeah.
or a cheese sauce, it soaks it up to a nice vinaigrette or whatever you're going to put on it. Those florets are absorbent in a way that few other vegetables are.
And you talked to this New York chef, his name is Tyler Cord, and he wrote an entire cookbook dedicated to broccoli, right?
That's right. And Tyler Cord really loves broccoli, and he is, I mean, if broccoli becomes the next kale or Brussels sprouts. You know, those are other cruciferous vegetables that have recently been enjoying their moments in the sun. Tyler Core will deserve a lot of the credit because he, at his restaurants, he makes a broccoli sub. He makes a double-decker broccoli tacos fashioned after the Taco Bell double-decker tacos.
Oh, wow.
And he does a fried broccoli, and he's got this whole cookbook. He's got a lot of exciting broccoli dishes.
Okay, and he says he used to hate it when people would overcook it and it would get all mushy until he went to Pizzeria Mozza here in L.A., and that changed his mind. And let's hear a little clip of tape.
They had a pizza on the menu that said mozzarella, tomato sauce, and then it had the phrase long-cooked broccoli, which I was like, what? I wonder if that's what it sounds like. I don't know, so I ordered it. And it was exactly what it sounded like. It was a bunch of broccoli that they looked like maybe had just gently braised with olive oil and some chilies and salt and cooked it until it was mush and then put it on a pizza. And it was phenomenal. I mean, it was what I love broccoli. I eat it all the time. But this was like, I'm sure that they sat for a little while and talked and like, they were like, how do we put that on a pizza without saying overcooked broccoli?
That's from your podcast. And so are you a convert, too? Do you like the mushy broccoli?
I like it when it's still got a little bit of firmness, maybe a few bits of crunchy stem mixed in there just for again, that textural contrast. But, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that you can cook it for so long and it turns soft and delicious. I think the only question left is if you love overcooked broccoli, is it even overcooked? Can you overcook overcooked broccoli? I don't think so.
Okay. Well, all right then. Let's talk about something that a lot of us don't eat when it comes to broccoli, and that's the stem. And you're saying, yeah, eat it.
It's so silly the things that we get caught up on about what we'll eat and what we don't eat. If you actually look at a broccoli stem, just look at it, and then if you actually cut it open and eat it, it's a kohlrabi.
What's a kohlrabi? Kohlrabi
is another cruciferous vegetable, popular in the farmers markets. It's the thing that you get in from your CSA, your community supported agriculture,
that
that you don't eat, or you have to Google what to do with it.
Right.
It's actually quite delicious. It's funny because kohlrabi has all these long stalks, leaves that stick up off the part that people eat, and people cut those leaves off and throw them out, even though those leaves are almost identical to kale. All these cruciferous vegetables, all kissing cousins. And so you can eat the whole kohlrabi and you can eat the whole broccoli. And if you like kohlrabi, you'll like broccoli stems.
Okay, what's your favorite way of cooking the broccoli stem?
Just steam them so they're a little bit cooked, but then they remain super crunchy and they're like chips. I mean, they're crunchy. They have a lot of flavor. You can dip them into anything and mm-hmm. they will be good.
All right, now since it's lunchtime and you mentioned earlier that there's this thing called a broccoli sandwich, and you know, I just have to say that doesn't sound terribly appetizing, but why don't you try to convince me that this is something I should have for lunch?
Well, it is delicious. It is a broccoli sub. This is one of Tyler Cord's creations. Again, he's from Number 7 Restaurant, Number 7 Sub, the guy in my podcast. It's a broccoli, steamed broccoli with some salt, ricotta salata, which is a sort of a dry, salty cheese. Lychee moochum, which is something he invented. It's basically pickled lychees. It's lychees that have some sort of vinegar and spice kick to them. And then mayonnaise. And the recipe also calls for pine nuts, although he doesn't always do that in his restaurant. But I love the pine nuts there. And it has a little crunch, and it's got salty, and it's got spicy, it's got kick.
I have to say, though, it sounds delicious because of all the other ingredients.
No, the broccoli. I mean, look.
I mean, the ricotta salata.
Do you like the taste of broccoli?
Delicious.
Do you like the taste of broccoli?
Yeah. I mean, it's not ricotta salata, but okay.
Well, I speak the same public radio news lingo you do. What do you do when you have a broccoli story? You got to soak it in some butter, throw a little cheese on it so the listeners are happy, right? So same deal with broccoli. You know, little cheese never hurt any broccoli. but it does have its own special crunch in that sandwich that I think I'm a big crunch guy that really makes it delicious that you wouldn't get. And there's also a structural integrity component to broccoli in a sandwich. It's hard to sandwichize some vegetables.
Yeah.
It's hard to keep them, to cut them just the right size so they are big enough to be toothsome, small enough to stay in the sandwich and not have the whole thing come out in a bite. You know, if you take asparagus and lay it on a long sub roll and don't chop it up, it'll fit in there perfectly. But when you bite into the sandwich, you're going to pull out half the asparagus in that first bite. So these are structural engineering challenges that the broccoli sub addresses.
Dan Pashman, broccoli I don't know, what are you, evangelist? Broccoli evangelist?
Sure. Okay. I'll take it.
And host of the Sporkful podcast and the Cooking Channel web series, You're Eating It Wrong, both of which can be found at sporkful.com. Dan, thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.
And my lady, she went downtown. She bought some broccoli. She brought it home. She's chopping broccoli.
Dana Carvey on Press Play. All right, if you want to weigh in, I really want to know why you think broccoli has such a bad rap. You can leave us a voicemail, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or leave a comment on our Facebook page, KCRW's Press Play. Well, coming up on the program, 40 years ago, parents and their children sang along to songs like It's All Right to Cry. How Free to Be You and Me created a cultural moment of gender-neutral parenting. What happened when those kids grew up? That's next, after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Does that sound familiar? Well, if you were a child in the 1970s, you might recognize that opening song from the TV special Free to Be You and Me. That special aired 40 years ago this month. The TV special was one part of a multimedia project that also included a record and a book. Free to Be was the brainchild of actress Marlo Thomas. Its goal was to encourage kids to defy gender stereotypes.
Jill told Bill that it was lots of fun to cook. Bill told Jill that she could bait a real fish hook. So they made ooey gooey chocolate cake, sticky licky sugar top, and they gobbled it and giggled.
Glad to Have a Friend Like You, sung by Marlo Thomas. Carol Hall is a composer and lyricist, and she wrote that song as well as two others for Free to Be You and Me. And she joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline.
What's it like to hear that song again?
You know, I'm just sitting here at my desk smiling. Just. It makes me feel wonderful that it still means something to people,
yeah.
And it reminds me of why I wrote it. I mean, that particular song had to do with my desire to hold up a mirror to what then were my own kids. My daughter, I think, was something like 8. I haven't done the math,
mm-hmm.
And her brother was 6, and I wanted to write a song as simple as it sounds. The song needed to be about things that didn't cost a lot and that you could do whether or not you were a boy or a girl. And you could bait a hook, a fish hook if you were a girl, and you could cook if you were a boy. And as odd as it may sound now, those were quite radical ideas. So it was kind of a love song to my kids on a good day when they were playing together.
Well, how did you get involved in this whole project?
I'm not sure. I had been a songwriter. I was somewhat of a struggling songwriter, although my biggest credit was that Barbara Streisand had sung a song of mine called Jenny Rebecca. And I was pretty much just starting out, and maybe it was Jenny Rebecca, which is a lullaby for children. Maybe that was what it was. I don't know. I was around trying to be a writer, and somebody called me up and said Marlo Thomas had this wonderful idea. And the minute I heard it, I knew it was for me.
And did you feel like you were part of something groundbreaking at the time doing this?
I felt that what we were doing was very unusual and very specific. I remember saying, I wrote two other songs. One is called Parents, our people, and it's about all the jobs parents can have.
Mommies are people. People with children. When mommies were little, they used to be girls like some of you. But then they grew, and now mommies are women.
Marlo tells a story about buying a book for children that said things in it like, boys are the doctors and girls are the nurses. So I knew that I wanted to write Parents Are People as a kind of radical other view. And the other thing I really wanted to write about was that it was all right for little boys to be tender and to cry if they needed to.
Okay, we're going to hear a little bit of that. It's All Right to Cry, sung by the football player, Rosie Grier.
It's all right to cry. Crying gets the sad out of you. It's all right to cry. It might make you feel better.
Well, how do you think these songs, 40 years later, and their messages hold up?
I think for the most part, they hold up very, very well. I don't know that it's a big deal anymore about whether or not boys cry, but I would be kind of curious to hear from some moms and dads about that. I do think Glad to Have a Friend Like You is something that can still be true.
I wonder, Carol Hall, about your own kids, because your kids were of that age to listen to this music and get the messages. And how do you think that, if they did, these songs affected them?
I know they did affect them, and there were some funny things. One was that there was a line in Parents Are People about how mothers can be doctors. And my son said, that's while I was writing the song, he said, Mommy, that's wrong. And I said, what do you mean that's wrong? And he said, mommies are the nurses. And so I was immediately radicalized to a mouth foaming, you know, crazy. I knew at that moment in time that we had to do this because this was important work.
Carol Hall, composer and lyricist, she wrote three songs for the Free to Be You and Me album and television special. And it's been really great talking with you. Thank you, Carol.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
Here's another clip from the Free to Be You and Me TV special.
So many young men wish to marry my daughter, and I don't know how to choose.
You don't have to choose, Father. I will choose, and I'm not sure that I will choose to marry anyone at all.
Lori Rotzkoff is a cultural historian, writer, and teacher, and she's co-editor of the anthology When We Were Free to Be, looking back at a children's classic and the difference it made. Welcome to Press Play.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's talk about that clip of the princess and how revolutionary was it back in the early 1970s to have a princess say she might not get married at all.
Atalanta. That's such a great story. It was quite a bold story for the time, and it was rooted in Marlo Thomas's very fervent desire to introduce children, and especially girls, to the idea that getting married and finding a husband was not to be the be-all, end-all of their lives and of their existence. And she was very determined to get this message across. This story touched a nerve and won the hearts and minds of a whole generation of kids, especially girls, including Marlo's own niece, Dion, who was the original inspiration for the Free to Be project. And she has gone on to say that this was her favorite story and really has inspired her and so many other women to expand their horizons beyond what was seen in the 1950s in the post-World War II baby boom time as being the central occupation for women, which was to get married at a very young age.
Well, I wonder if you could step back a little bit and give us some context of how this project came to be. And it came about during a time when the women's movement was really ascendant. This was in the early 1970s. And give us some cultural context.
It originated with Marlo's idea, but of course, during this time, there was so much happening with the burgeoning of the women's movement on so many fronts and in so many ways. There were efforts to challenge almost every arena of politics and culture. There was the fight for reproductive rights and reproductive freedom. There were efforts to raise awareness about rape and sexual harassment. There was the development of domestic violence shelters, efforts to get more women in politics, and of course in the workplace, battling the glass ceiling, improving the pipelines for women to access so many career fields where they had literally been excluded, sex and gender discrimination in the workplace, equal pay, areas in the arts, higher education, really in almost every aspect of society. So why not children? This was an effort to bring progress to the playroom and to change the landscape of childhood in terms of the books children read, the curriculum materials they learned about in school, their access to sports, toys, so many aspects of the way that children experience their lives. This is what the Free to Be project was all about.
You were a child back then, right?
Absolutely.
How old were you?
I was 3 years old when the Free to Be record, when the record album LP came out. And I literally remember learning to use our family's record player. This is when it was all on vinyl LPs. Uh-huh. And so I was really one of the first generations to grow up with this music and to listen to these stories. And it was a very formative part of my own childhood and really shaped my ideas about gender equality and ambition and all of the aspects of child rearing that Free to Be was focused on.
So you remember singing along to the songs?
Absolutely. And not only that, but my neighbors and I, we would put on shows in our basement, and we would charge our parents and other neighbors like 10 cents for admission, and we would make our own backdrops and our own scenery, and we would actually commandeer my brother to play the cameo role of Williams in William's doll. And he actually had a doll, so he was our favorite actor for that scene. And I wasn't alone. What I found out is that Free to Be became such a huge part of children's recreational lives. They sang the songs in school. They put on plays. It was in so many aspects of the culture.
So looking back now, what do you think? Do you think that it had a lasting impact? Do you think that we've slid backwards a little bit? It seems that gender stereotypes are alive and well in the culture and in children's toys and entertainment?
Yeah, I think the answer to that question is both. I think on the one hand, it has had a lasting impact. But in terms of gender stereotyping in childhood, especially when it comes to popular culture and toys, as you mentioned, we have seen a backlash. And in fact, this backlash began a while ago, probably a good 20 years ago, if not longer. The 70s were kind of an idealistic moment where gender-neutral child-rearing was a little bit more ascendant. And there was an effort to encourage kids to play with toys that were not so bifurcated in terms of gender.
I'm wondering about your children. Have they seen Free to Be You and Me? And what do they think about it?
Oh, many, many times. Well, first of all, the fact that I was working on this book for many years while they were in their formative sort of early childhood years, I feel like they've really grown up with Free to Be You and Me more so than even a lot of kids of their generation. They really like it. Of course, now they're 12 and 15, so they've kind of moved on and they're more interested in other things. But they really love the songs. And in fact, my older son just auditioned for the performing arts elective at his high school, and he was asked to sing a song, and he chose Parents or People. And he did a really nice job singing it. So at this point, he's kind of he used it in his own efforts to get involved in the performing arts, which I was really excited about. But even when they were younger, they loved a lot of the songs. They love It's All Right to Cry. And when they were young and they got upset, I would always refer to that song. Of course, I also told them that the song did not say that it's okay to whine. So we had a lot of discussions about the difference between whining because you want something and somebody was telling you no, and crying because you were genuinely sad about something. But they really liked the songs and the stories, and it was a big part of their childhood, too.
Lori Rotzkoff, she's a cultural historian and co-editor of the anthology When We Were Free to Be, looking back at a children's classic and the difference it made. Lori, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Take my hand. Lead me to 1 o'clock.
Takes you back. Takes you back. Parent or child, whichever way you were looking
does,
at all of that,
yes,
or listening
indeed.
To it. Lovely, lovely stuff. We're going to be talking about something less lovely. It is the president's visit to Europe, mm-hmm. where he made a very passionate speech today to a group of young people, calling on history and the history of the United States and Europe in particular, advocating European and American unity in the face of what the Russians are doing in Ukraine. And so we'll be talking about that and getting a sense of how some Europeans feel about it.
Okay. We will look forward to that in just about 15 minutes from now, 1 o'clock, to The Point and Warren Olney. And just before that, we're going to be talking about the arrest today of State Senator Leland Yee from San Francisco. He was arrested along with a reputed Chinese gangster. We'll find out more about that coming up on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The feds arrested Democratic State Senator Leland Yee this morning at his home in San Francisco. His arrest was part of a string of raids across San Francisco and San Mateo that also netted infamous Chinatown gangster Raymond Shrimp Boy Chow. San Francisco Police Chief Greg Sir described the raids to KCBS as massive and involving hundreds of officers. Senator Yee is the third Democratic state senator this year to be indicted on corruption charges by the FBI. He's also running for Secretary of State. Joining me now are Josh Richman, who reports on politics for the Bay Area News Group in San Francisco, and Katie Orr, who covers state politics in Sacramento for Capital Public Radio. Welcome to both of you.
Hi. Thank you.
Well, let's begin with you, Josh, and tell us what happened this morning at Yee's house and throughout San Francisco, and if you could also tell us what the indictment says.
Well, we don't have the criminal complaint against Senator Yee just yet. We're told that he and others arrested this morning will be making their first appearances in federal court in San Francisco within the hour. But what we definitely know is that FBI agents have been raiding sites in Sacramento and San Francisco and San Mateo County this morning. They are still carrying boxes of papers and bags of other material out of the Chinatown office of a Freemason lodge that appears to be involved in this somehow. We had seen San Francisco firefighters carrying heavy saws in there earlier as if to open a safe of some sort. And we are waiting to see exactly what the connection is between Senator Yee and this somewhat infamous Chinatown gangster named Raymond Shrimp Boy Chow. It sounds like something out of a Dashiell Hammett novel.
Yeah, it's really odd. Tell us more about what you know about him. Who is he?
Well, he has a long, long history going, a rap sheet that goes back to 1978. Multiple federal racketeering indictments, allegations of attempted murder, murder for hire, gun trafficking. He was originally indicted, actually, many years ago in a federal racketeering program, a probe that targeted the alleged leader of a Chinatown gang named Peter Chong. And Chow actually cooperated with federal law enforcement against Chong, who had fled to Hong Kong after being indicted on these charges. Chong was later extradited, eventually convicted. Chow did time in federal prison, but has been out for the past 10 years and has a lot of ties to the social and political establishment in San Francisco. His social media pages are full of photos of him standing with some prominent figures and accounts of him accepting some awards and such. So he's very, very deeply plugged in. Law enforcement officials, though, have always looked at him with a jaundiced eye and have believed that he's never been up to any good, even after getting out of federal prison a decade ago.
All right, Katie Orr in Sacramento, what's been the reaction there this morning to all this news?
Well, I think the reaction when people got up and saw this is, are you kidding me? Another state senator, Democratic state senator, facing some serious charges. As you mentioned, this is the third senator this year to Senator Ron Calderon has been indicted on public corruption charges. Senator Rod Wright has been convicted of felony voter fraud. And now we have Senator Yee being arrested by police and by the FBI and all of these raids. I think it just really makes people stop and think, is there something going on within the Democratic Party? Of course, party leaders have not said anything yet. Actually, the Senate president, Senator Dianne Feinstein, was scheduled to have a media availability this morning at 10. That quickly got postponed. We have yet to know the time. He says he's going to talk later on this afternoon, but they haven't given us a time just yet. But he's got to be, you know, he knows he's going to be facing these questions of what is happening in your party that within a span of 3 months, we have three different senators facing very serious charges.
Right. And I already see that the Republicans have a hashtag on Twitter that is culture of corruption. So they must be pretty gleeful today.
You know, I think just from the political standpoint, suddenly the Republicans are relevant. They were not relevant in the Senate. You know, the Democrats had a supermajority. They had 27 seats, which is what they needed to get through basically anything they wanted. When Senator Calderon and Senator Wright took leaves of absences, that dropped them down to 26. And so Republicans became relevant again because they needed that extra vote to get things having to deal with taxes and fees and constitutional amendments through the Senate. And now, depending on what happens with Senator Yee, the Democrats might lose another seat, at least temporarily. And so I think the Republicans are, to some extent, probably reveling in their relevance for a little bit here.
Right. So they don't have the supermajority anymore, the Democrats. So is it going to be a lot harder to get stuff through?
I mean, I think so. There's, you know, several water bond issues that the state is wanting to deal with. There is a rainy day fund that the Democrats had wanted to start get going. There are some constitutional amendments, and they're going to have, at least for the time being, they're going to have some buy-in from the Republicans, and that will change those bills. They didn't need that buy-in a couple months ago, but now they do. And so it probably will make things a little bit harder to get through, and it will probably change the nature of the legislation that does get through.
And Josh, what is the view of Leland Yee in San Francisco? What kind of politician was he known as?
He certainly was not under any kind of suspicion as far as we could tell. This is sort of blindsided everybody as far as we can figure out today. It's not something that we saw coming as we did with the Calderon indictment. As we said earlier, Senator Yee is among the candidates right now for Secretary of State. He's tried to make a name for himself as a good and open government advocate. And in fact, when he pulled his papers for that race just last month, he had issued a statement saying that he's committed to empowering Californians so they can guarantee fair elections, expose special interests, and prevent corruption because it's your California. His campaign spokesman declined to comment this morning.
Right. Madeline, I should say we found out that just recently the Northern California chapter of the Society for Professional Journalists gave Senator Yee an award, a good government award, for his role in rolling back the proposed changes to the Public Records Act that journalists were all fired up about last spring. He's been a big defender of that.
And
that was
correct.
Really recently.
He had gone toe-to-toe with Dianne Feinstein over that and reportedly took some heat for having done so. And so was recently honored as a First Amendment champion.
Right, right. And also called for transparency when it came to revealing the salaries of UC and Cal State leaders, I understand.
Yes, that as well.
And he really took on the violent video game issue. He was really staunch about that, introducing several bills that eventually got defeated in the courts.
Yeah, his background, he has a doctorate in child psychology. So prior to his service in the Senate, he served in the Assembly. He served as a San Francisco supervisor. He was a member and president of the San Francisco School Board and has worked in child psychology as a vocation.
All right. So next is within the hour, we're going to actually see this indictment. And then after that, what happens?
Well, our understanding, first of all, is that it's a criminal complaint filed by the U.S. Attorney's Office, not an indictment as reviewed by a federal grand jury.
Okay.
The net effect is the same. It's a criminal charge against him. We expect that he'll make an appearance in court. The charges will be aired. We've been watching the court's record system, and we have a reporter at the courthouse so that we can get the substance of these charges as soon as possible. It's possible he will go ahead and enter a plea today, which almost certainly will be a not guilty plea, as things as they usually are at first court appearances of any sort. And we'll see how it gets scheduled from there.
And then we'll see, Katie, whether or not he will step down.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know that that will be happen anytime soon. We saw with Senator Calderon and Senator Rod Wright really dug in their heels initially, and then when it saw we looked at it, saw that the politics was getting really bad, they eventually took leaves of absences. So we'll just have to see how it plays out with Senator Yee.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Katie Orr, reporter for Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, and Josh Richmond, politics reporter for the Bay Area News Group. All right, Jolie Myers. What's in your mailbag?
Madeline Brand, free to be you and me.
Yep.
I have to say that I have zero recollection of any of this, perhaps because
you weren't born.
That might have something to do with it, maybe. But we had a lot of listeners who do remember it, and they wrote in, Karen Pelland says on Facebook that the title song of the special chokes her up every time she hears it. My song like that is Changes by Tupac. I get misty every time I hear it when I'm rocking K-Day in my car. Martin called in and he said he loved the special.
And I'm telling you what, I've sung that song ever since I heard it when I was 10 years old or whatever.
Let's hear that again.
Let's try it again. Sorry, everybody. It's not playing. Okay, so he called in and he said that he's been singing the song since he was 10 years old and he just cannot stop singing it. He was so happy to hear it. Sorry that you
Sadly, we couldn't hear his voicemail.
But
anyway.
Yeah. Nina Jo Smith says that her son loved Free to Be You and Me. He's 36 now and still sings the songs when he's putzing around his house. I have another voicemail. Should we give it a try?
Let's try.
Okay. Well, listener Aaron called in with a story about his son and broccoli.
My son, when he was 2 years old, we took him to 31 Flavors and told him he could get a flavor of any kind of ice cream he wanted. And he looked around and wondered, where's the broccoli?
You want a broccoli-flavored ice cream. I have to say that if you go to one of those hipster ice cream places, I bet you can find
there.
It.
A kale one, maybe a kohlrabi one.
Right, exactly.
Okay, Jolie Myers, thank you for that.
Thanks.
And that'll do it for us today. To the Point is up next with Warren Olney. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.